Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Time for our Friday gathering this week. I'm joined by Deputy Leader of the Green Party, Spokesperson for Rural Development, Trade and Employment, Senator Roisin Garvey, or at least I hope I am. She's on her way into the studio now, I think. Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Midwest and Party Spokesperson on Housing, Oona Brin, Political Correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail, Aisling Maloney, and author of Pandemonium and the Irish Times Political Correspondent, Jack Horgan-Jones. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Oona Brin, can I start with the housing policy that you've given us? A little bit of a sneak peek of, but isn't actually going to be launched for another few weeks yet. According to the man sitting beside you on the front page of this morning's Irish Times, you're going to be scrapping the Help to Buy scheme over a number of years in order to fund it. Expand on that, will you?
Sure. So I suppose what we're looking for, if we're in government, is a new deal with private residential builders and developers. What we want to do is put in place a series of policies that support them to build far more private homes, particularly for people to buy at more moderated prices. Jack has a kind of an analysis piece inside the paper that details this in more depth, I suppose. But when I'm talking to residential developers, SME builders or the larger players, they're telling us there's far too much risk and far too many obstacles at the early stage of development. That's increasing the length of time it takes to get developments done. That's increasing the cost, and that's impacting on the price. So actually, the bulk of what we're proposing are ways of removing those barriers, significantly increasing resourcing for local authority, planning departments and board panola, providing extra funding for judges in the planning environmental court, but also crucially supporting the SME sector, for example, with more low-cost finance, better site servicing, and using planning and zoning much more efficiently. As you do
not
that,
all of which can be done from scrapping Help to Buy. Presumably there are other parts of existing housing policy that you're going to have to raid to fund all of this.
No. So I think you might have misunderstood the article. So all of those policies will allow good quality builders to build good quality homes at more moderated prices. And as you do that over a number of years, what you can actually do is to start to phase out Help to Buy, because while some people benefit from it, lots of other people don't, because it pushes up house prices and they're excluded. And then there's a whole pile of really expensive, really wasteful direct subsidies to developers, many of which actually the developers are telling us aren't working. They just all need to go. So this is about, I suppose, a complete change of policy towards private residential development, supporting, activating and removing barriers at the early stage of development, making sure more good quality private homes get built. And that's alongside our very ambitious plans, one, to dramatically ramp up social housing to reduce council waiting times and homelessness, but also, as we launched last week in some detail, how local authorities and approved housing bodies would deliver tens of thousands of genuinely affordable homes. This is about increasing social housing, affordable housing, and private for purchase housing, which much better policies, because the current government's policies are failing. House prices are rising, rents are rising, homelessness is rising, and a generation of young people are locked out and giving up hope that they will ever get to own a home. Our detailed alternative housing plan, full detail of which we'll obviously publish at the start of September, is about offering hope that people will be able to get affordable homes to rent or buy on the volume and scale that's needed.
Now, I'm wondering here, Aisling, politically, what kind of a message is Sinn Féin sending here? Is it one that tells those who are financially secure enough to enter into the Help to Buy scheme that we're not really looking for your votes, we're going to go and look for those frustrated renters?
But potentially, but I suppose, like, you know, obviously Owen touched there on the whole cost rental and affordable housing and beefing up that, and obviously that is a cornerstone. You've been talking about that for a long time, and I also think what Owen is outlining today about scrapping Help to Buy and those other developer schemes, none of that is kind of shocking. You have signalled that very much, very strongly up to now. But I suppose my question is, you know, when we talk about housing, I mean, everyone needs a home, so what are you doing, or what's going to happen to those people who really do need Help to Buy? Because there are a huge cohort of people who are working as hard as they possibly can, getting, you know, trying to get the best job they possibly can, to get the best salary, to be out there renting because they don't have a home, paying a very high rent and not being able to save. And that's what those people are, they're relying on Help to Buy. I know someone who bought a house in the last 2 years, and they said to me, like, in their mid-30s, have kids, you know, they're starting their life, they said to me, everyone on our road got Help to Buy. So
and after 2030, under your proposal, that Help to Buy wouldn't be there.
And the crucial thing is, why do those people need to rely on that scheme? Because government policies have pushed up house prices so high that they can't afford them in the more traditional sense.
But that can't be undone overnight either.
No, but that's why we're talking about phasing out the Help to Buy scheme over 5 years, but crucially putting in place a whole series of policies from year one. That the consequence will be a threefold increase in the number of private homes for hardworking people to buy in the open market at reduced prices. What we need to do here is stop the upward trend. The idea that it now costs in Dublin 400 to 500,000 euros for a modest starter home. 70% of first-time buyers can't even buy those homes. They need to buy second-hand homes further and further away from Dublin because of the price. So what this is about is delivering more good quality homes in the private sector for people to buy at more moderated prices. But also many of the people that have been spoken about are also eligible for our affordable homes because, of course, the income threshold is up to 90,000 for a single or a couple. And we can, and we've showed how we can do this, deliver really good quality homes delivered by local authorities and approved housing bodies at prices of 250, 260, 270,000 euros. What's the government offering in affordable housing? In all in development cost and ultimate purchase price, up to half a million euros and so-called affordable rents at 1,800 euros. This is about affordability, both in the public sector and the private sector, and it's about scale and supply.
Let's move it on a little bit here, can we? Front page of the Daily Mail today, Roisin Garvey features a story about advice to the Minister for Finance that there was absolutely no way the number of houses that were suggested were going to be built in the month of May were actually going to even get underway. And then there was that story yesterday as well about the landlords. It appears that the government has been handing out taxpayers' money to landlords based on very, very dodgy data, very dodgy numbers, and helping some people to buy first homes with a scheme that raised prices for the worse off, locking them out of home ownership for even longer here. You really haven't got a handle on this, have you?
I suppose do I have to speak on behalf of the whole government? I'll give it my best shot. I suppose the thing is, we started from a very low base. We have been building more houses in the last few years than have been built. You know, I can't say we've got it perfect. I have to agree with Owen. The more houses we built, it is very difficult in a marketplace where there is a lack of demand, a lack of resources to stop people from hiking the prices. I do think there is an issue around builders or maybe auctioneers even charging an arm and a leg. I see it down in Clare all the time. You have a derelict house on a half an acre and it's going for 100,000 euros.
Let's deal with the specific issue that I raised, though. You believed, it would appear, the line that came from bodies like the Irish Property Owners Association, that there was an exodus of landlords from the market. There wasn't.
No, that doesn't seem to be the case at all. And I think that's not necessarily a bad thing.
What isn't the case? That you didn't believe them?
No. The reason they were saying that there would be a mass exodus of landlords if we didn't give them incentives.
Yeah.
But they, like, the thing is, we need more people to rent more houses. We have a huge issue down in Clare where every second house is either empty or Airbnb. So it's, you know, there's definitely a big Dublin focus on what Owen is saying, and I appreciate that he's based in Dublin, but there's a huge myriad of solutions and issues, and like scrapping all the assistance that the government are giving is not going to solve the problem, I'm afraid. I totally agree with Owen, we need to build a lot more houses, but I do know, for example, we have reached social housing targets in a lot of our local authorities. I know in Clare they exceeded it, for example, so it's not all bad and we have to give people hope. And also scrapping the Croí-Cónaithe fund is also a very dangerous thing to do because we have plenty of empty properties that are now, I know in Clare alone there's 300 empty houses being turned into homes, so that's not a bad thing either. Now, it's taken a while to get off the ground, but that's because new ideas take a long time to actually implement, and people have a fear around
Jack
new
Morgan
ideas.
Jones, did the government get played for fools by the property owners, the landlords?
Well, certainly this suggestion that there's a mass exodus of landlords from the private sector seems to be at odds with the data. Now, I think there's an overriding question of how willing the government were to believe that thesis. Certainly, it was placed in the foreground of the budget discussions last year. In fact, even prior to the budget, there were suggestions that there would be a kind of, you know, summer statement tax break for landlords. But I think the most important outworking of this new piece of data from the RTB that came out yesterday is how it informs the budget decisions this year. And it's something I'd be interested Roisin's view on as well. You know, should there now be more tax breaks for landlords in this budget, or is that proven to be a bit of a fallacy? Or conversely, could they make the argument that the tax breaks that were given to landlords in the budget last year are part of the reason people are staying in? I think there's another wider question as well, which is that the variation in the data that we've seen on the rental sector, it seems to suggest that we don't really have a firm grasp of the shape and size and composition of the rental sector. There was another report recently done by, I think, was it the Parliamentary Budget Office, which effectively identified thousands upon thousands of kind of shadow or informal tenancy arrangements, which are only now being registered for presumably a variety of reasons. Some tenants may be pushing for it because they want to get the rent tax credit. But I think we have a data problem, first of all. And when you have a data problem, then you have a policy problem. So you need to start solving all these things to address the shape and size of the issue that you're trying to address before you actually go in like a bull at a gate with policy interventions that may end up proven to be ill-founded.
Owen O'Brien, would Sinn Féin remove that tax break for landlords?
Absolutely. And not only that, because landlords are getting two tax breaks, because the so-called renters tax credits that Dara Bryan introduced is going straight to landlords through rent hikes because they didn't ban rent increases in parallel with it. Just let me correct two things that Roisin said that aren't correct. First of all, we've never proposed abolishing the derelict and vacant sites refurbishment grant. In fact, we've talked about improving it and reforming it. And also, unlike the government's plan, which isn't delivering any affordable homes to rent or buy in most rural counties, our affordable homes plan would actually do the very opposite. It wouldn't just deliver homes in Dublin, but in every county in the state. Jack is right about the data in the private rental sector. I actually think the RTB, after some years of really struggling with the data, is producing some very, very good data, which must inform policy. And Jack also referenced a report that, again, was produced by the CSO and the RTB, looking at the gap in 2022 between the census and the RTB. So three things. First of all, there are landlords selling up. Let's be very clear. But they're being replaced by mid-size and large property landlords moving into the market. There is a very, very large number of landlords, anything between 25 and 35,000, who should be registered with the RTB who aren't, according to that CSO RTB report. But also, let's not kid ourselves. The solution here isn't actually more landlords. We need a private rental sector. It needs to work and function properly. But actually, huge numbers of people in the private rental sector don't want to be there, shouldn't be there, but have been forced in there by bad government policy. A third of private renters should be in long-term social housing. If we had more affordable housing to rent or buy and more moderated cost private housing. So actually, the solution to the pressures that are currently in the private rental sector is for government to increase and accelerate the delivery of social affordable homes and work with residential developers to build more private homes for people to buy. And in doing that, stop badly regulating the private rental sector and do it properly in the way many of us have been arguing for some years.
Roisin Garvey, you gave €50 million of money to landlords that they didn't deserve on the basis of bad figures. Why now not reverse that?
I suppose if you look deep into it, I think we have to distinguish between there's the big landlords that own lots of property, and then down in
who pay no tax. Thanks to your government, they pay no tax on rent.
Don't interrupt me, Owen. I'd really appreciate it. I'm just going to answer the interviewer's question without interruption. Thanks. I didn't interrupt you when you were contradicting me.
What's your answer?
So I just think we have to differentiate. It's a bit like all farmers are polluting the waters or are causing climate change. You know, we've all kinds of landlords as well as all kinds of farmers. Down in Clare, most of the houses are owned by individuals who have one or two other homes on top of their own. And I would believe that those landlords actually do need incentives to go into long-term rental, because at the moment they're only doing short-term rentals. Because the easiest way to get people in increased housing is to get the existing housing stock available to people who need a place to live. It's not all about new builds. And of course we need to, I mean, nobody's disagreeing with Sinn Féin having this brilliant idea we should build more houses, because that's what we're trying to do. Everybody's agreeing that we need more social and affordable housing, 100%. That's not a brilliant new idea. That's what we've been trying to do. But there is a huge issue of a lot of houses either empty or derelict or locked into short-term rental. And if a tax incentive will help them, at the moment it's like €600 a year. It's not huge money to entice somebody who's doing a short-term rental to come into the long-term rental sector. So, you know, it is a challenge, because you see, when you give grants or you give incentives, you know, it isn't always a solution, because some people are just downright greedy. Like the bike to work scheme, you know, it did increase the price of bikes in some shops, because some people are there to make lots of money. And it's the same with landlords, but they're not all evil, and they don't all need to be deserving incentives.
Yesterday on this programme, somebody from the Irish Property Owners Association said that grant wasn't actually incentivising anybody to stay in the market because it was insufficient. So why not just remove it and spend that 50 million somewhere else?
Yeah, I mean, we have to look at why it's not working. Is it not working because it's not enough, or because there's no point because they don't want to get into that sector, you know?
So are you contemplating actually giving more money to landlords on the basis of an exodus that isn't happening?
I think if we could pigeonhole it, ring fences for landlords that maybe only have one or two extra properties. So it doesn't have to be, like, we have the ability and we have the IT and we have the mathematical ability to not have a blanket grant for everybody. If you've got landlords who have 70 properties, like our good friends in Kerry, they don't need incentives, okay, you know? So, but I do think there is, we have to have a separation, have an intelligent debate about this. And all landlords can't be categorised as ones that don't need any money and we're giving them all billions of euros. Right.
Let us move on to social media and the Taoiseach's promise to get tough on those social media companies who are in any way contributing to levels of unrest here and abroad. Jack, I think three different points in today's programme this has raised its head, the role that social media companies are playing in all of this. Is it possibly to effectively regulate and control their behaviour?
The evidence to date would suggest either that it's not possible or that the sustained effort that needs to be put in place to actually police behaviour on these platforms has not been there. And this is part of the issue. We keep hearing about these kind of big pieces of reform, whether they're legislative or new bodies being set up, like Commissioner Naman and so on, who have different areas of responsibility within this notional future that we keep being promised, where these companies are going to be properly regulated and held to account for the things that are posted on the platforms. But it's a long time coming. You know, and there's also this issue that there seems to be in this space, and I'd extend it to the data protection space as well, that there's an over-reliance, or there's an overemphasis, I think, on the kind of the fining powers that exist within the new regulatory bodies that are being set up. And they are headline grabbing because they are titanic amounts of money, you know, X percentage of your global turnover. And when those fines come through, they do look to be
big,
you know,
but they're
really
not
big. But are they a disincentive? You know, like these companies, they have a license to print money, and nobody seems to go after the license rather than the money. If you have a license to print money, you can always print more of it. But if someone changes the terms and conditions of the license, or for example, goes after and makes criminally or civilly liable the directors of these companies for, you know, going offside or not policing the content that gets spread on the platforms effectively enough, you know, that would seem to me to be a much more meaningful disincentive than just, you know, taking a small percentage of a very large number.
It's very easy for you in opposition to talk tough on this and play a hard game, or say you're going to play a hard game once you're in government. But what we're talking about here is the central plank of the entire country's industrial policy, foreign direct investment. How tough can Sinn Féin realistically really play with these companies?
Well, I don't accept for a second that FDI investment is in any way connected to regulation of digital media platforms. I mean, first of all, this isn't a new issue. Obviously, the death threats against Simon Harris and Mary Lou have brought it back onto the public agenda. But for example, women politicians, politicians from minority ethnic communities, LGBTQI politicians have been receiving death threats and rape threats for years and years, and people in the wider public receive this. The challenge here for me is I've long argued that we need to move to a situation, first of all, where social media platforms are considered and regulated as publishers, and also far greater exposure and regulation of the way in which they use algorithms to promote hateful content through people's feeds is dealt with. The difficulty is we have to deal with the EU's Digital Services Act, because actually the Digital Services Act creates, I think, quite a restraint on the scope for individual member states to properly regulate. And what I'm really interested to hear from Simon Harris is it's all very well talking tough for an August media headline. What is he actually proposing? What is he actually going to do? And is that permissible? Because we had something similar under the Digital Services Act in terms of the regulation of online letting platforms. And we had industry telling us, oh, you can't do that because of the Act. Now, we don't accept that on that issue. And therefore, I think if a government is serious about properly regulating this industry, they'll find very willing partners in the opposition to do it. But I have yet to hear the detail, and today in the Financial Times, very worrying story about a secret deal between two social media platforms playing fast and loose with the rules to target minors in terms of advertising and letting platforms. This stuff is way beyond the Wild West. But the debate, as Jack has said, and I think he's right, has been going on for far too long. Politicians at a European and a member state level have introduced very, very light touch self-regulation. I can say things on social media that I am not allowed to say on this
platform.
In
this studio.
And that Jack isn't allowed to say in his. That is not right. Okay. These are publishing platforms and should be regulated accordingly. And if we have to do that at an EU level as well as a member state level, let's just go and do it.
Aisling, is the reality here, as a digital native, somebody who is much more au fait with this technology and what these companies are doing to circumvent all of this regulation, that they are always going to move faster, that they're always going to be more innovative and leave officials and governments just looking really flat-footed?
Yeah, that's the conundrum that always faces legislation, that it takes a longer time to create this legislation and get a handle on it, and the technology has moved on. We're seeing that with AI. We haven't even begun to regulate that. So, and especially when, you know, at Jack's point there about, you know, is a 6%, that's the fine if you don't comply with the DSA, the Digital Services Act, it's 6% of your turnover. And to give people context, if you breach the GDPR legislation, it's only 4% of your turnover. So you see an increase there. But if you're Elon Musk and your platform is created, or at least it's succeeding in whatever way you classify success, on breeding division and discord, even with his own public comments, we can see that when he said that civil war was inevitable in the UK. I mean, it's very clear what his intentions are. He would probably incur a fine in order to keep doing what he's doing. Do you know what I mean? Because it's his business model at this stage. And while social media was set up as maybe one thing, Mark Zuckerberg to rate your mate's pictures online, it has now kind of morphed into this business model that is profiting on hate and sowing discord
and division. Speech.
And, well, you can't say certain things we just said there. You can't say it here. You can't say it in a newspaper. But yet you can say it very freely online. But also, this becomes, every single day, this problem becomes worse because you have more children and more young people who are spending more of their time online because it becomes a greater facet of society. The younger the people are that get the technology, the more it becomes a part of our society and the more influence it has.
Just on the free speech point, though, you know, that can be elided in some ways by effectively bad faith actors. You know, a death threat is not free speech and shouldn't be protected as such.
Roisin Garvey, none of this is really new. All of this was known back in 2020 when your Green Party colleague Catherine Martin ended up taking up the portfolio with responsibility in this area. What has she done in those 4 years?
There's been a lot of research done and work in trying to figure this out. I mean, I think the online safety code is coming by the end of the year, so through Commissioner Newman, so that is a positive. Let's hope we get it across the line before the end of the year. I think it's timely that we have it. But I think there's a greater issue here because, as Jack or Owen said already, there's only so much you can do as a state with these global corporations. That's the first thing. So we can try all we can. We need to get our MEPs, and we have them out there, to see what they can do around stronger regulations, European regulations, to strengthen our hand around this. This is not just an issue in Ireland. This is an issue globally. But also we have to do more to warn parents that when you put a phone in your kid's hand, you're handling them a potential bully, a mental health issue, a physical health issue. You know, we're not taking the damage we do with mobile phones seriously enough. And, you know, that's why I suppose it's important to invest in things like playgrounds and walking and cycling infrastructure and safe places for kids to play. Because, you know, at the end of the day, when kids are on mobile phones, it's a form of entertainment for them or for their parents or whatever. So we need to look at the bigger issue here.
Well, hang on, let's look at the bigger issue for a second. Is it not time to start considering these things a public utility, something like electricity or water, access to Wi-Fi, I mean, and that it needs regulation and maybe even ownership along the same lines?
Yeah, I think you're going to find it hard to stop getting people to buy, stop people controlling their mobile phones. I do think it's good we're going to have them banned in primary schools. Personally, as an ex-secondary school teacher, I would not allow them to have them on their person during class time. I would give them to maybe at break time or after school. And I mean, there's this thing now where parents want to be able to contact their kids. You know, let the teenagers be in the room with their peers doing their work or having the lols with their friends and not constantly, you know, I think as parents we need to look at this. Like my son is 25 now. He was wanted a phone for years. He got one when he was 15. But the age is getting younger and younger. It used to be confirmation. Now it's first communion in some cases. But like, who is in charge? The phone is going to be in charge.
That wasn't really my question. Let me put the same point under Bryn.
But the online commission is important.
For bigger, clear blue sky thinking in this area.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about at an earlier stage, other infrastructure, if you think of transport, I mean, transport at one point at the end of the 19th and early 20th century was owned by small numbers of very, very powerful people who ran a completely unregulated market. And at certain points, the state, including the state here in the 1930s, decided, first of all, to regulate it and in certain parts to nationalise aspects of the service. I'm not going so far as some writers in terms of nationalising Facebook or Twitter, but you have to start by putting in place a set of very, very basic regulations. And again, I keep going back to the simple point about publishers. These platforms are publishers. When I go on to Twitter, I'm doing the same as I'm doing on this radio show.
They obviously say no, we're not.
No, but they're wrong. But it goes down, and Ashley is 100% right. They say that we're not because it suits their business model. And again, it's not just the online platforms. It's all sorts of uses of digital technology in the gig economy, for example, in short-term letting. There is a wider issue here, which is very, very smart people have realised there's ways of making enormous amounts of profits and sidestepping regulation in more traditional fields of social economic activity. Online platforms are one, the gig economy is the other, and politicians, and it is MEPs, but it's also governments at the Council of Europe and it's the European Commission, have been come in hock to these very powerful commercial interests. That has to stop in the interest not just of children, but the interest of social cohesion, because the damage that we're now seeing as a consequence of, exactly as Aisling said, algorithms that are designed specifically for one reason and one reason only, which is, in my view, to generate money, promote huge amounts of hate from sources, as Jack said, that we don't know who they are or
let's
where
talk
they
about
are.
Another
and it's
source.
Not, just to say this, it's not about free speech. It's about fair speech, responsible speech, and proper and fair regulation in the public interest.
Let's move on and talk briefly before we finish about another source of social cohesion, the Olympics. To somebody of my generation, Aisling, it is absolutely astonishing that we are enjoying this much success at the Olympics. To somebody of your generation,
We deserve it. We should have the best athletes in the world. And this is the kind of, like, you know, Daniel Whiffen, he's so confident. That's the kind of confidence you need to go into in the games. You're going into, like, the best of humanity. They're the people who have invested their whole lives to be the best physical performance. We need to also believe that we are capable of that. And actually, Ireland is uniquely situated. And I'll tell you this much. In Australia, to get on the Australian swimming team, you've got to be, you don't even have to be the best in the world. You have to be better than the best in the world. You nearly have to be overhuman, because the people in that get on that team are amazing. But we're a small country. There's so many opportunities to get on an Irish team. And that's often why you see people claiming Irish, you know, maybe the granny rule, getting Irish, because they can get on an Irish team and get to the Olympics. And that's a huge opportunity. We are also uniquely situated, I think, because of the GAA having a very unique national sport where you can, if you're the best, you can win the All-Ireland. That's an opportunity that if you're the best American football player or the best basketball player, you're not always going to win the Super Bowl or whatever the basketball equivalent is. You might be the best or really good, but you never get to the top.
I wanted to let everybody else in the field in on this conversation, but I'm afraid I can't. You just sprinted so far.
We all endorse Aisling's enthusiasm 100%.
Oh yeah, love it. Yeah. Love the athletics. Love it all. I'm going tomorrow. Up Ireland. Come on.
Here.
Thank you very much, Roisin Garvey, Eoghan Brin, Jack Horgan-Jones and Aisling Maloney. That is all that we have time for. The programme was produced by John Byrne, researcher A.B. Philbin Bowman, broadcast coordinator Michelle Gibson, and on sound Aisling Grofferty. Now to Flack Yolnaherin in Wexford and Louise Duffy. Good afternoon, Louise.